I'm a former undercover police officer, so I essentially used to catch drug dealers for a living. And I accidentally got into that, really. I wasn't one of these people who was ambitious to be a police officer as a child. I actually I dropped out of university, having gone to university by mistake. I've no idea why I thought I would be interested in business studies. It's a very peculiar thing to think. Now, looking back, I just can't put myself in the brain of my 19-year-old self. So I dropped out of university, and I was going to do the hippie thing and go backpacking around Europe, like some friends of mine had done. But then I saw this advertisement for the police in the newspaper, my local newspaper, and I applied. Well, I couldn't make my mind up to start with, so I flipped a coin. It came up heads, and so I applied for the police. So it wasn't exactly life ambition. And when I was in the police, I was terrible at it. I was an awful uniformed police officer. I didn't realize how naive I was until I was in that uniform, and I didn't deal with conflict particularly well. But I only stayed in for the first 2 years, I think, just to prove to myself I could survive, rather than any great ambitions. But I stayed in, and after 4 years, I got an attachment to the drug squad. Now, the reason that some of us young rookies got attachments to the drug squad at that time was because there was the biggest moral panic going on in the United Kingdom at that time. Major panic, the biggest of all of them, because tabloid newspapers had been whipping the public up into a frenzy of fear about the impending doom of the epidemic of crack cocaine, because they were constantly featuring horror stories of what crack cocaine was doing to communities in America. So by the time we actually got some crack cocaine on the streets of the UK, everyone was already terrified. This generated a political reaction from the government, responding to the public's concern. And the government, the Home Office, instructed every chief constable in the United Kingdom to prioritise drugs above all other policing topics, above everything, with a particular emphasis on heroin and crack cocaine, seeing the growing connection between those drugs and crime as well. So, with that directive, my constabulary in Derbyshire was looking for ways to satisfy the government pressure, and there was pressure then. There was a pressure to create numbers, to fit into league tables and prove by numbers of arrests, etc., that the police were doing something. So I got an attachment. The idea was to share the expertise so that young cops knew what to do. But after a couple of weeks, one of them said to me, "Do you fancy having a go at buying some crack?" And I thought, well, I wasn't exactly expecting that question, but I'll have a go. And I was given this £20 note, and I was directed to this Blue Terrace store in the city of Derby, and knocked on the door, spoke to this dealer, realised I hadn't even got a cover story at all. He said to me, "Who are you then? Are you a student? You're not a student, are you? I fucking hate students." And I thought, that'll do. Yeah, I'm a student. He obviously thought I was very stupid for announcing myself as a student, but he still sold to me. And actually, as I was walking away and I've got my little paper twist of crack cocaine, he said to me, "You take care now, don't get yourself arrested." So the first time I did it, nice enough chap, really. And the point is that it wasn't difficult in 1993, because whereas we'd got a long tradition of intrusive, high-end undercover work in the UK, we'd never done this low-level undercover work. It was completely new. They've been going on in the United States, of course, for a long time. They've been doing these low-level hits on drug dealing corners for a long time, but it hadn't happened. So organized crime, or even individual freelancer dealers, had absolutely no idea that this tactic was being employed. So it was a bit of a shock. But of course, within a year, enough people had gone to prison and talked about it with other people that, of course, they all then knew about this tactic, which meant that very quickly I had to get my act together. Because that first day that I'd bought crack, that basically changed, that dictated the next 14 years of my life and beyond. My life changed that day. And as soon as it started to get more difficult, as soon as they realised that tactic was out there, I had to develop new ways of fitting in, and it became more and more difficult, literally, with every passing operation. So I was going from a few days deployment for a few weeks, and then no less than 6 or 7 months in any one location. So I was spending my time travelling across the UK from as far north as Leeds and as far south as Brighton and lots of places in between, and developing the tactics as I went on, because for the first 4 years, there was no training either. I helped develop the training later on. And, you know, I tried out all sorts of things that almost got myself killed. I decided to start with that in terms of the way that I should appear, I should dress in all in sportswear, you know, the Nike Air Max trainers, the Adidas two-piece tracksuit, baseball cap, you know, no disrespect to anyone listening to this who's really into their sportswear. It's just it so happens to be the uniform of thieves. And so I wore this, and it opened a few doors. You know, I could pretend to be a bit of a travelling car thief, travelling burglar. But what I quickly realised is that the people I was meeting that was most useful to me were the people who were really struggling with life, who were either homeless or they were on the edge of that homeless community. They were living in squats. They were the most problematic users. And the reason they were the most useful people for me to get to know is because they were using way more drugs than anyone else. And because they were using way more drugs, they knew all of the people. And some of them had connections that could help me jump up the ladder. They actually had connections with the sort of regional gangsters who employed runners and user dealers, so they could get me connections higher up the ladder, which is what I was trying to do, to gather evidence of conspiracy against gangs. So I started to dress like them. I started to dress like I was living in squats, and I practiced techniques of leaving my filthy clothes in a plastic bag overnight, tying it in a plastic bag and leaving it in a warm place so I really smelt the next day, which my colleagues hated, of course, and that they would laugh at me for this, for the state I was getting myself into. But the truth of it was, it became a situation where I was at the beginning of any operation. That's how I would dress, and I would seek out the most vulnerable people, the most vulnerable, for two reasons. The one reason I've already said is that they have the best connections, but also the most vulnerable people are the easiest to manipulate. It's true. It's a cold truth. Now, if that seems ruthless, well, of course it's ruthless. That's the point. And really, it's a microcosm. It's a small reflection on the broader war on drugs, prohibition drug policy, because it follows the principle that we can cause harm to some individuals or small groups in order to achieve some aim. So the theory that the end justifies the means. And I became aware that I was causing harm to vulnerable people, and that the worst thing in their life that could happen is that they could meet me and get to know me, because they're going to end up doing prison time. They're going to get emotional damage. I became acutely aware of this, actually. And I had to wrestle with this. I had to think it through in my head. I had to justify to myself that this is what I should do. And the way that I did that is I just went through the process of thinking that the end does justify the means, that I am going to be causing harm to these people. But at the end of the 6-month, 7-month operation, I'm going to be locking up some gangsters who were literally murdering, maiming people and kidnapping people, you know, so that I justified this to myself because these people were genuinely the worst characters in those communities. And so it was a payoff. And my colleagues didn't really seem to have this ethical wrestling at all. It was just, this is just what you did. But it was a struggle for me. Now, one of these people who I picked on, and this was for an operation in Nottinghamshire. And the target for this operation was a very infamous gangster in the UK called Colin Gunn. Now, at the time, I had to do that operation because there was essentially a war going on between Colin Gunn's group, the Bestwood Cartel, and all of the other gangs in Nottingham. And he was just murdering people. You know, there was daily shootings. And the shootings at that time was so prevalent that it got into the front pages of the newspapers. And I think my favourite pun of that time was Shottingham. And there was even talk of the control of the constabulary being taken over by the government from the chief constable. It was a very real political thing. So there was lots of pressure on me to find intelligence about this ongoing violence. So I found this very vulnerable chap called Cammy, and he was perfect for me because he was on the periphery of that organisation. He was a user dealer, and he was on bail at that time for dealing heroin. Absolutely perfect for me to get introduced to the people that I wanted to meet. So I really went overboard on Cammy. I really wooed him. I befriended him. I listened to his problems. I sat and listened to him and chatted with him. And I liked him, actually. He was good fun, you know. He had a real interesting observational humour. He lived a part of that community, but he just had a wry way of observing people. And so he was good company. And, you know, I spent a bit of time with him. I went shoplifting with him, which was great fun, by the way. It was really good fun. You know, if you know you're not going to get sent to jail for it, it can be great fun, especially if you take turn in being lookout, you know. But I digress. So I spent a lot of time with him. And after several months, you know, I got introduced to some lieutenants of the main gangster and got lots of evidence. And it was a hugely successful job, as most of them were. I think there was 56 people arrested. But the trouble is, Cammy also got arrested at the end of that seven-month job because he was committing offences on bail, and I'd provided evidence of that. A couple of weeks after the operation, I heard that actually when Cammy was in police custody, he ended up being on minute-to-minute watch, suicide watch in his cell. And the reason for that, as he told his interviewing officers, was that he saw me as betraying him, and that this betrayal was just the final straw for him. For somebody who had had a traumatic childhood, struggled with the neglect he'd had as a child, and was trying to cope with that with heroin, this was just the final straw. It was too much for him. And that was what sent him over the edge into being suicidal. Now, this was a massive blow to me emotionally. I really struggled with that. And I actually gave up undercover work at that when I heard that for a while. Not very long, though, because a few weeks later, I got a phone call from the detective sergeant who sort of organised these kind of events around the country. And he said to me, look, Woodsy, we need you to do this next job because these gangsters are even more vicious than the last ones. They're even worse than Colin Gunn. They're even worse than any of these people, because they're not just doing the normal gangster stuff like kidnappings and shootings and that kind of thing. They're using gang rape as part of their reputation building, as part of their intimidation, as their dominance of their marketplace. Now, it's a very infamous gang called the Burger Bar Boys. And at that time, they were very infamous because four of them had been arrested as being involved in a double shooting of two young women, Letitia Shakespeare and Charmaine Harris. That they'd machine gunned them with I think they're Ingram MAC-10s. So they were infamous for that murder, and basically they said they wanted me to catch these six who had taken over the supply in Northampton. So I was in my cell. I was myself manipulated into carrying on. And I remember the DS saying, look, we've sent two people in already to try and get close to these people, and they've not managed it. So look, we needed to do this. So, and I was perhaps not in the best mental health state to do it, but I went into it. Anyway, I did my usual tactics. I picked on some vulnerable people, a couple who really supported each other in their problematic heroin use. She was self-medicating to cope with sexual abuse that she'd received as a child, and he was self-medicating for a long-term physical illness. And they managed, you know, they supported each other. She did very well selling the Big Issue magazine. I was good at selling that. She always had the best pitch, and he was a really good shoplifter. So they managed okay. And I manipulated them. I made myself out to be a major thief. So I got them to introduce me to all of the local handlers of stolen goods. So I know who to go to with spirits, with baby clothes. Baby clothes are a great tip, you know, if you ever want to get into shoplifting, baby and children's clothes, because they're always growing up, aren't they? And they always need new clothes. And if you're poor and you want to clothe your children, that creates an incredible market for it. So maybe people shouldn't be quite so poor. But again, I digress. So I got them to introduce me eventually directly to the Burger Bar Boys. And that was the most terrifying experience. I got taken to where they were holding court. They sort of had their headquarters in a local, in a town centre snooker club. I remember getting directed in, into the toilets. I can see you use the word toilets, don't you? For American audiences, I always have to try and remember to use the word washrooms, which always seems a bit daft to me. But anyway, so they're directed into the gents, the male toilets, and this hooded figure came in, and the door burst open. This hooded figure came in, and he walked in, climbed onto the toilet, shut the door, and looked over the top and said, "What's this?" The moment he did that, the door burst open again, and these four hooded figures came in, and they started walking slowly around me. Now, my mate had come in to reference me, to introduce me, and he was literally physically shaking, and he was basically telling lies that he'd known me for years. And the guy in the cubicle was asking me the questions and rephrasing them. And all this time, I'm being interrogated. These four figures, hooded figures around me. Every so often, one would headbutt me on the ear, like really hard, or another one would jab me in the ribs, and then the other one would headbutt me back. So I'm being jostled around, and my ear, I'm starting to feel pain. And it was just the most intimidating situation. The feeling of imminent violence was just extraordinary. And I was rapidly coming to the conclusion I wasn't going to get out of there in one piece. When suddenly he said, "All right, then, what do you want?" And I said, "I'll have one and one, please," meaning a 0.4 deal of crack, 0.4 deal of heroin. I exchanged the money, got the deal, and I got his phone number, which was. So the most difficult thing from that operation was that day, really, because as soon as I had the phone number, then I started buying increasing amounts from them, gathering evidence from conspiracy, and so I was in. I was amongst them for months after that. One time, they decided they were suspicious of me, and they bundled me into the back of a van and took me to the edge of this park and made me strip and showed me a gun tucked into a top of a these trousers to make it clear that I wasn't going to argue with this. They just said, "You're 5-0, man. You're fucking 5-0. You're heat." And I remember looking at him thinking, "There's no way you're old enough to have seen Hawaii 5-0, but you're still using that as a slang." And it's funny what you think of in those moments, really. Another weird thing I thought about is when he lifted up his t-shirt to show me this gun was tucked into some tracksuit bottoms. I remember thinking, "How the hell is that staying up in those tracksuit bottoms?" He must have a really tight drawstring. Again, it's just weird what goes to your head. I suppose it's his way of distracting yourself from imminent death, I suppose. But you know, they were genuinely terrifying. And every single day, I had that sense of impending violence. Like today might be the day that I'm in serious trouble. And that went on for months. But after 7 months, I'd managed to get evidence against 96 people. 96, that's so the six main gangsters, but also sex workers, runners, user dealers, people stashing, all huge network, much bigger than you would expect for a town of that size. And I thought, wow, this is incredible. I've got evidence against everybody because there's no new people to meet, no new names I haven't heard already, no phone numbers I have, new phone numbers I've got. And so so this is it. This is gonna wipe the town clean, you know. Anyway, there was police brought in from five different counties, hundreds of cops involved, enormous operation. And then I spoke to the intel guy, the person who was keeping his ear to the ground for the impact afterwards. And he says, yeah, we managed to interrupt the heroin and crack cocaine supply in Northampton for a full 2 hours. 7 months of work, 96 people arrested, almost dying on who knows how many occasions to interrupt that supply for 2 hours. Now, I don't know for certain that the infamous rivals of the Burger Bar boys, the Johnson crew, were the ones who took up that opportunity to fill that gap in the market. But you can imagine the conversation, can't you? The gang gathered round. Wow, boys, put the call in. Guess what the police have done for us? This is fantastic. We're going to make a fortune. And of course, that's the truth of it, really, because, and now as part of the Law Enforcement Action Partnership worldwide, I speak to cops all over the world, literally. And I know that my stories, my experiences are not in isolation, and that the way that works is the same at every level all over the world. All the police do is create gaps in the market. And the truth is that police are really, really good at catching drug dealers, really good at it. But that's part of the problem. That is part of the problem, because police never reduce the size of the market. But police activity does change the shape of that market. So what we do is we manage to create opportunities. And when we create those opportunities, violence more often than not increases. Worse than that, the people who are most able to take up those opportunities usually are rival gangs or rival dealers. So if we catch a gang that controls a quarter of a city, the gang that's most capable of taking up that opportunity is a gang that controls another quarter of the city, which means that a gang or individual dealer or kingpin character has an increased share of the market. And if they have an increased share in the market, they have more disposable income to invest in corruption. So it is the mechanism of policing drugs which actually increases the likelihood and does actually increase corruption over time. We see this taking shape with the entire corruption of some West African nations like Guinea-Bissau. They're now narco states, and that's because of international policing activity, particularly targeting the cocaine transit routes. And this is what we're doing. But basically, how do we challenge the police narrative? Because the problem we have is that the social movement is prevented from growing because the police control the narrative. And there's nowhere in the rich nations on earth that's a bigger problem than Australia. And it's one reason I'm very fascinated with Australia and really want to try and kickstart the debate there if I can get there to visit. Because it's the same problem everywhere, but in Australia, you've really turned it up to 11. It's a desperate situation of the public following what the police say. There's essentially three ways in which the police control the narrative, and they do it by repeatedly showing the same images, which reminds the public that they've got something to be scared of, but also provides the public with the salve that there is something being done about that. And those images are the images of the police smashing doors in the morning, the image of a rows of mugshots of the gang that the police have caught, and most importantly, of course, is the images of the drug seizure, you know, the hay bale-sized blocks of cocaine or the big mountain of methamphetamine or the big cannabis grow or whatever it is. These images are put out time and time again, almost on a daily basis in social media. And this is preventing the social movement growing, because the vast majority of the public are reassured that that police activity is dealing with the problem that is being highlighted to them. Now, at LEAP, we seek to try and persuade police to return to the basic principles, Peel's principles. Sir Robert Peel set down in 1829 what policing should be, and it's as relevant now as it is then. But the war on drugs has breached every single one of those principles. And the ninth of those nine principles is that the evidence of police success should be the absence of crime, not the evidence of police activity. And all the police are presenting to us with these images is evidence of activity. And we can say from our policing experience at LEAP that that activity does not reduce crime. On the contrary, it increases crime. And that very basic message does persuade the public. When we get the platform, we win people over with that, because we can challenge that police narrative. We're working on new ways to do so. And as an interconnected movement, anyone across the world who believes the war on drugs should end, we need to be having some message discipline and working out the best possible ways of challenging those police narratives. And one little tool that I've created for that, with together with Anyone's Child, is a video, social media video. It's a tool for people to use on social media. So with that, thank you very much for listening.